Welcome to Now You Know Politics. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, I'll be speaking with Kelly Donathan, the Senior Specialist in Disaster Operations for Humane Society International. Kelly has been working tirelessly on the ground, rescuing animals in Australia as a result of the horrific fires. Tune in for the latest update on the situation and to find out all the ways we can help. No matter where in the globe you reside, there's something that we can all do to help. Thanks for listening. Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I know that you just got back from being on the front lines in Australia, and you must be extremely tired and extremely busy. So thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
To begin with, for people listening, can you just give us a sense of the scale of what's happened and what's continuing to happen with the fires in Australia?
Sure. So, I mean, I think as much as of the world knows, the fire season in Australia is something that does happen every year. But this year, temperatures being hotter and the weather just being drier, the fires have burned far more intensely and on a much grander scale than they have in the past. And my experience was focused mostly on the fires that hit Kangaroo Island, which is the third largest island off the coast of Australia. In the first week of January, the fires there burned about a third to almost a half of the island, which destroyed the Flinders Chase National Park, as well as other habitats for a lot of the wildlife there. So it's been something that's been rather unprecedented in terms of scale. And obviously, there's still fires burning through lots of the mainland of Australia, and it's just really wreaked havoc all over the country.
Is it just on Kangaroo Island alone that 1,700 square miles have burned?
Yeah, I think that is the figure for now. It's quite amazing. Yeah, of the island, it is. It's about 1,700 square miles of the island has burned. And, you know, I don't even know what the current figures are for some of the fires burning on the mainland. It just continues to grow. And thankfully, when I left the island a few days ago, the fires had mostly been extinguished at that point there. But, you know, there's still concerns about, you know, the risk of fires still popping up here and there with the season still being pretty dry and hot. But yeah, as you said, it continues just to grow massively in other parts of the country.
So I think we're seeing here anyway in Canada, and I'm sure in the States, we're seeing so many images of singed koalas. And I know you've been working with all kinds of animals. So I was just wondering if you could kind of give us a good idea of all the different types of species that you were on the ground working to save.
Yeah, so koalas have definitely been a focus of a lot of the recovery efforts, both on Kangaroo Island and in the mainland, partly because of just their typical nature and behavior is that we're often able to find them and access them fairly quickly, as opposed to some of the other animals that still, you know, their defense mechanism to evade capture is still very strong, even through, you know, having severe burns. So we were able to access quite a lot of koalas, and in particular on Kangaroo Island, it's a bit unique in that it has such a high density of koalas there. So even though we were coming across hundreds and hundreds of them dead, we were also still finding many alive. And so that was one of the key species we were working with, as well as the Kangaroo Island subspecies of kangaroo and wallabies as well on the island. We were oftentimes, unfortunately, if we were actually able to capture any of the survivors, they were usually in such a bad state that they had to be taken to the clinic for humane euthanasia. Otherwise, you know, we monitored injuries from afar through binoculars and worked with the vets and local people there to determine, you know, what their survival capacity was, really. We did come across a few other species. We found a young bandicoot that we were able to get in. It was relatively unharmed, but was severely dehydrated and malnourished, and I'm not sure exactly what happened and why it was separated from its mother, but we were able to get that to the clinic, which is being taken care of well, and a few of different possum species, which unfortunately were all so badly injured that they, you know, also had to be humanely euthanized. And echidnas we were finding quite often. Echidnas were kind of a pleasant sight to see because they are an incredible species that very resilient to fires, even these fires that were so intense and fast moving, that all the ones we were seeing were actually still doing quite well in the habitat. We did have one that had some minor burns that we took in to checked out by the vet, but we just were able to relocate it to a better habitat. And luckily they do quite well in that situation. But there were other species concern that we didn't personally really come across or deal with, but we know, you know, the Kangaroo Island Dunart, which was already an endangered species, and there's great fear about, you know, the main habitat for this species was severely damaged by the fires, as well as a subspecies of the glossy black cockatoo, which luckily we did see a few flying around, so that gave us a lot of hope. But I think it's still, you know, we'll be anxious to hear from researchers, you know, what the actual damage was for those species.
It's not even possible to absorb the number of animals that have perished in this. It's so hard when you have statistics and like numbers that are like in the hundreds of millions. How can you even begin to wrap your head around that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, even just seeing, you know, the devastation on the island there and, you know, in some places, the number of corpses that you would just see laying around was really astounding, something I hadn't quite experienced before. And I think it's somewhat unique to fires, especially there, because the remains are still relatively visible. But even, you know, we come across clusters of bones that if you touch them, they just kind of incinerated into a powder. I mean, they were just so, such a hot, hot fire. And I think what actually was even harder to deal with were the bodies of animals we were finding that hadn't actually died in the fires, but we knew, you know, had recently passed from dehydration and starvation. And I think that's what really drove us to get out there each day and try to reach those animals before they succumb to that secondary wave of trauma. So
I was reading, just preparing for chatting with you today, I was reading a great article by Genevieve Radjewski. She's from Tufts now. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting because when she was quoting you, I was just shocked to hear that, like, this is what you do and you've never seen anything like this. And you've been doing this kind of work for many years. And it was just really sad when you were talking in this article about how, you know, how compromised things are for a koala when it's just willing to go up to humans. And it's just immediately that to you is like a red light that even the ones that appear to be okay and healthy are just so severely traumatized. I was just wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I think it's also a really important piece to talk about because, you know, so much in the media, there's been this depiction that, you know, the koalas, you know, are very, you know, relatively docile in nature. And, you know, maybe they are, you know, accustomed or, you know, comfortable around humans to be, you know, the numbers that have been picked up even by, you know, people of the public. And it's really not that they are, you know, grateful for, I mean, I'm sure they're glad to get out of that situation, but it's a little presumptuous to think that they are actually, you know, really kind of willingly coming to us. In reality, they're just so compromised, as you said, you know, they're so exhausted, they're so malnourished, they're so dehydrated. And traumatized too, especially the young ones and the joeys that, you know, have also now suffered trauma of being prematurely, you know, separated from their mothers. It's always, you know, the less they fight, you know, when you first pick them up is always a concern. I'm always grateful when I see one that does kind of put up a bit of a challenge to bring into the clinic, because I hope that will serve them well in rehabilitation, that they have enough reserve there that they still want to, you know, fight for their life. And the ones that really just kind of go limp in your arms are, you know, are really critical that we have to get in immediately. And so it was, you know, definitely part of our criteria for deciding when to bring an animal in, because obviously our number one priority is to keep animals in the wild. We really don't want to intervene if it's not necessary. But if they're on, for koalas, especially if they're on the ground, especially in their kind of normal sitting posture, which is with their head kind of curled into their lap and their arms wrapped around, that to us was, you know, a sign that something was wrong. They mm-hmm. weren't up in a tree as they normally would be. And then sort of the ability to walk up quietly to them, even if they did stir and watch, you know, kind of just faces come up to them. That's just not normal behavior. They would have immediately gone up a tree, even if they had been on the ground, if they were able to. So, you know, we always knew that that was a sign that this animal was in need of intervention, that needed probably veterinary care and at least access to hydration and appropriate food for them to recover.
That's what I was just going to ask you about that. So in the situation where an animal seems to be doing okay there, but considering makes such extensive damage to the ecosystem, what do you do in that situation? Like, especially, I guess, with an animal like a koala that moves so slowly and eats such a specific diet, how are you able to determine when to leave an animal and when to, are some animals being relocated?
Yeah, for the koalas, the ones that are still high up in trees, you know, every day we assess those animals. We made GPS pins so that we knew where they were, and we would go out every day, even sometimes twice a day, to check those areas. Oftentimes we'd always find more down on the ground each time we went out. So we wanted to make sure we were there for them as soon as they were reachable. But if they were still strong enough to maintain, you know, normal behavior up high in the trees, and some of the trees, as badly damaged as those forests and plantations were, we were seeing some new growth, or at least some parts of the trees that hadn't quite completely suffered entire damage. So we kept an eye on the areas. If they seemed like they were doing okay, we also put out water stations, even though it's not, you know, really normal behavior for koalas to come down and actually drink, since they usually get most of their hydration through the eucalyptus leaves that they eat. We still provide that as an extra option, especially because some of the water holes that were out there were so contaminated with the bodies of other animals that had fallen in or, you know, died on the edge. So we were trying to provide fresh water, which also was helpful for some of the other species like the kangaroos and the wallabies that were living around those areas, to kind of help give them a boost.
It sounds so unimaginable. It must be incredibly emotionally taxing for all of the people on the ground there.
Yeah, the community spirit and feeling of everyone just kind of, you know, all hands on deck and working together was really amazing. But you could see the toll on everyone. But even people that we, you know, hadn't known prior to this, we were checking in on each other, making sure people were getting breaks as needed. But it was an incredible, you know, group effort to really try to do this work. And it's continuing, obviously, even though the search and rescue phase of it has largely dropped off. There's still so many people and groups there continuing care for these animals, and we're committed to help as well in the long-term plans for these animals, and hopefully getting as many of them back out into the wild.
What kinds of numbers have you been able to rescue? Are there enough people? Are there enough volunteers and organizations over there, or is more needed? I know you said the main rescue effort has now sort of come to an end.
So the rescue side of things, I mean, I think, you know, on an average, probably most days, about 50 or so animals would be brought into the clinic there. And that might not seem like quite a lot, but it still felt like a lot, and didn't mean that we were always bringing all of those in. You know, we, you know, averaged about maybe 5 to 20 animals a day, depending on, and it was odd. Some days we would have far more animals we'd find, and other days, you know, it'd be a little less. And it was sort of difficult to explain why that was. The area was so vast, we obviously had to focus our efforts in places that we knew other teams weren't working in. So there was definitely other groups, and a lot of just members of the public were finding animals or calling in. We would go out often on calls where people said, you know, there's koala in our yard, or you know, animals that they had spotted and, you know, weren't comfortable handling themselves. And so we would go out and assess those situations. But now I think the phase is moving much more into putting out more feed and watering stations, especially out in Flinders Chase National Park. And I know the RSPCA is out there. They've put out a call for volunteers to help run those stations, and that's going to be a long-term effort as well. So, you know, we're on standby to support those efforts as needed.
Is it the case that the fires are completely out on Kangaroo Island now, but there's still some fires burning in other parts of Australia?
Yes. So when I left the island, it seemed, at least for the most part, that the fires had largely had died off. There could be a few little ones still popping up here and there, but we had a few days of not constant or massive rain, but a bit of rain that I think really helped, in some cooler temperatures. So that helped bring a lot of the fires down. So as far as I know, there isn't anything massive still burning on Kangaroo Island. But that said, there are still fires burning, especially in New South Wales and Victoria.
For people listening that are all around the globe, what do you recommend? What can we do to help?
Donations are still, you know, hugely welcomed. We're, you know, at hsi.org, you know, we're happy to take more donations, as we're committed to the line. This is not going to be, you know, a situation that is quickly dealt with. And these animals are going to need months, if not years, of help, as well as the communities and, you know, the other habitat protection that will need to go into place. So I think if people are willing and able to give financially, that is the best way to donate. I know there's been a lot of requests that I've received about, you know, donating mittens and pouches to some of the carers and other types of donations. Right now, especially for the folks in Kangaroo Island, they just can't absorb any more in-kind donations. It's been incredible what people have given, but now I think what's really needed more is those financial donations so that they can, you know, put the money towards what they need, mm-hmm. you know, as they need it. Because like I said, this is going to go on for quite a long time. And I think the other thing that people can really, it might seem not quite as connected, but, you know, obviously these fires and the conditions have been exacerbated by climate change. And so I think it's important for all of us to really try to, you know, use the situation as a wake-up call if it hasn't already happened, that, you know, we really need to find ways to change our behavior and curb the impacts of climate change. And another, you know, really important way is to really consider the power of your vote and who people vote for, because we need global leaders who are going to take climate change seriously. And this won't stop. You know, when I stand and look out at these, you know, the miles and miles of burnt land, similar as I stood in, you know, Abaco in the Bahamas after Hurricane Dorian. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to see that immediate devastation, but then just know that this is going to just keep happening until we find a way to adapt and mitigate the impacts of climate change.
So Kelly, what is next for you? Are you going to be heading back to Australia?
Yeah, so we already have plans to go back. We'll be working with our partners at HSI Australia. I'll be going back to Kangaroo Island in about a month. So we'll be in touch with the folks we worked with, and we're still committed to providing assistance as well to other wildlife carers and groups on the mainland that may be in need of more urgent care and supports in the meantime. But like I said, we're committed to the long-term efforts on Kangaroo Island. So we'll be discussing with the folks there and the government groups and agencies to see what those long-term plans look like for rehabilitation and release for many of the animals that have been brought into the center. You know, people have been asking what those plans are, and they haven't been determined quite yet, because we've really had to get through this first triage phase and know what was going to be left in terms of habitat and how many of these animals are truly going to survive their injuries and their, you know, conditions of being through starvation and dehydration. So that's our next plan for now. Of course, we're on standby. If there are other immediate rescue needs in other parts of the country, we'll do whatever we can to support those efforts and help out. I'm excited to get back.
It's such a heartbreaking situation, but thank you so much for just being one of the heroes that steps in and helps. And also thank you for calling our attention to how all of this is interconnected with the climate crisis. So I think that is very empowering in a way, because that is something that we can all, you know, put effort toward changing in our various ways. So Kelly, I really hope you get some R&R now that you're back. So take care of yourself, and thank you again for being on today. Hope we'll have you back sometime soon to update us.
Yeah, thank you so much again for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kelly.